Welcome to another episode of TP Talks, PwC's Global Transfer Pricing podcast series, where we discuss key transfer pricing developments from around the world. My name is Christina Novak, and I'm a principal in PwC's U.S. National Tax Services Transfer Pricing Practice. In today's episode, we'll be diving into the recent guidance issued by HMRC on the accurate delineation of risk in controlled transactions. But before I get started, let me introduce today's guest speaker. Joining me for today's episode is Ian Dykes. Ian is a transfer pricing partner with PwC UK and is the transfer pricing global disputes leader. Ian, welcome and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Christina. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Glad to have you. So there's a lot to cover today. So let's go ahead and jump in. In January of this year, the UK released Transfer Pricing Operational Guidance, which addressed the role of risk with regard to the accurate delineation of actual transactions, and this ended up being incorporated into the UK's international manual. Ian, can you start off with a quick overview and explain the purpose of this new guidance?
Sure. So what HMRC have done is, as you say, they've included guidance in their international manual. The manual is aimed at tax inspectors, but it's made public. Okay. And in doing this, HMRC are the first tax authority to really set out a detailed interpretation of Chapter 1 of the Transfer Pricing Guidelines and what it says about allocating risk. So actually, the guidelines are fairly ambiguous. And this ambiguity has given rise to quite a lot of dispute within the tax arena. So in setting out how they believe the six-step risk process should be approached, HMRC are really setting out their expectations of the taxpayer. This is what taxpayers are expected to do. Therefore, this is what we can expect of HMRC on audit. And it really explains why HMRC have been so focused in the last several years on senior decision makers and a much more forensic degree of attention that's been given to the decisions themselves. Who makes them? Can we see the emails that demonstrate that, etc.? So this is going to be really of relevance to many taxpayers, principally in the UK, but also this can have a wider, ultimately will have a wider application. But I say principally in the UK because the UK has just introduced TP documentation rules. And the burden of proof in the UK on transfer pricing now lies with taxpayers. So HMRC have clearly felt it appropriate to explain what their expectations will be. And these guidelines are one place in which they're doing that.
So let's give our listeners a little more insight into this role of risk. So if HMRC is coming in and analyzing, you know, all of the decisions that are being made by the primary, the strategic decision makers within the group, what does that tend to do to the structures that are currently in place? And what exactly are the arguments that they are making regarding taxpayer structures?
Great. Yeah, I'll break that down a bit and perhaps we'll go into it in a bit more detail. But at a very high level, it's the case that most organizations, when they're applying transfer pricing, have kind of broken down the elements within their organization into parts that can be benchmarked and parts that earn residual profit. Now, when we benchmark an entity, more often than not, we're going to give it a fixed return. So the consequences of risk sit with the counterparty. Very often we'll have, for example, a contract R&D function or a contract manufacturing function or a benchmark distribution function. This is very, very common. Most transfer pricing systems have these features. And what HMRC are often finding on audit is that the characterization of the entity doesn't sit, in their view, doesn't sit comfortably with the fact that there are some relatively senior people in within those organizations. And what HMRC will assert very often is that they are making decisions about risks and that means there should be some greater attribution of profit to the entities that we have previously been treating as benchmarkable. So in a nutshell, that's the primary consequence and the thing that will be of most concern to most taxpayers.
So How does this concept by HMRC, how does it interact with our current rules? So what happens regarding the value of assets, the role of contracts? How does it interact with, you know, I think what typically people think about in transfer pricing and base their transfer pricing models on? So what is the role of contracts, I guess, and assets going forward in this world?
It's a really great question, because HMRC say that they do respect contracts and that contracts are important and that assets are important as well. But they say they're not the only things that are important. They say that risk is important as well, and decision-making functions are important as well. But that's actually, doesn't sound unreasonable, but it's actually quite a difficult concept to tie together, because more often than not, our transfer pricing analysis will have been based on us understanding, well, what are our sources of competitive advantage? Sources of competitive advantage attract residual profit from an economic perspective. More often than not, in fact, almost always, they're assets. And what HMRC are essentially doing is saying that asset ownership or contractual allocations of risk are only a part of the picture, and that actually, when it comes to explaining residual profit, risk taking is the, if you like, the wellspring of all residual profit. So yes, of course, we might point to assets and contracts, but HMRC will say you would never have built a residual generating asset in the first place if you hadn't made the decisions that led to you taking the risks associated with the investment in those assets. So it's almost as though you can kind of, you can kind of work your way back through the asset to the decision that was, that had to predate it. Now, that's an extremely difficult way of thinking about residual profit, but nevertheless, there are enough kind of hooks in the transfer pricing guidelines that might lead you to think, well, if it's true that there are certain special functions that attract a residual profit, and if it's true that they're control functions or they're functions that are really controlling risks, then how does that logic all hang together? And what HMRC are doing here is trying to tie all these things together. And within this tying together, you have to find a place for everything. But that's really difficult because, of course, there's only one lot of residual profit. And if we're not saying that our residual profit ties back to our assets, but actually some of it ties back to risk, well, how do we split it up? You know, these things go hand in hand in reality, but now we're having to think about them as separate components of our transfer pricing analysis. And there aren't many organizations that will have done it. And to be perfectly honest, there aren't many organizations that would know how to do it. And I don't know if I know how to do it, you know, but nevertheless, it's kind of, this is what's the inference behind this guidance, is that you can do that because we're now looking for individual risks. We're looking for the decisions that attach to those risks or that control those risks. And then we're trying to work out what the profit attribution or allocation ought to be to those risks. But that's not really how it works in real life. So that's why we're faced with a problem here, because a lot of people will be looking at this guidance and thinking, I don't really know how I'm supposed to deal with this.
In some ways, this almost sounds like HMRC is essentially arguing for profit split in all cases, and the allocation key for that being all of your key decision makers, which in my mind seems a little more like formulary apportionment. We're just going to look at the entire multinational group, take a look at where are our key strategic decision makers and divide profit based on that. Is that what they're saying here? Or
they would disagree that that's what they're saying. But in practice, when it comes down to trying to get a detailed understanding of how organizations make decisions, when it comes down to looking at the map of where individuals are geographically, and when it comes down to, if you're kind of wedded to this idea that there should be some residual profit that attaches to the decision making, then, you know, the way that HMRC are approaching this does tend to lead you to the conclusion that you just got to. And if you see in the analysis, you know, they say, well, one-sided methods may well be appropriate to price a decision-making function. and they suggest possibly cuts, but they don't go on to elaborate what kind of cuts they're talking about. And then when they get into the detail, it is really a headcount-based profit split. And as you say, that's essentially formulary apportionment, you know, unless you're dealing with an asset that's only made of people, essentially. So that's kind of where the issue lies. And it stems from HMRC's interpretation of the six-step risk process and what the role of accurate delineation is within that process. So again, it's getting quite technical here, but this does matter because it's in this six-step process that, first of all, we, or rather HMRC, will move away from a contractual allocation. And then, even if they are going to respect the contractual allocation of risk, they also, within step six of that process, say, even if we're not going to argue that risk is anywhere other than you've specified it contractually, we still think that contributions to risk management, so contributions to control, may well attract an upside and downside. Now, my challenge to that would be to say, well, if you've gone through this whole five-step process to work out whether your contracts are going to be respected, and you've decided that they are going to be respected, then to get to step six and say, but now we're going to still allocate upside and downside to a contribution to control. Well, what was the point of the first five steps if you're going to do that? But that's also something that the guidelines say. So again, HMRC would say, well, look, we're not saying anything that isn't in the guidelines here. So some of these issues that we're talking about are actually issues that exist in the guidelines. And HMRC, and to be fair, I think it's an important thing that HMRC have done here, even though I may disagree with their perspective on many of these issues. The need to get some agreement amongst OECD members about how to apply these very ambiguous rules is really important that we get some agreement on that. And if HMRC are leading that debate, well, good, is what I would say. But that doesn't make our life any easier in the meantime.
That makes sense. That provision that you were quoting, I mean, that's essentially paragraph 1.105 of the OECD transfer pricing guidelines.
Yeah.
So they're essentially taking that, and I think you had already said this, sort of out of order. Like, you should have already delineated the transaction up front, and paragraph 1.105 comes in later when you're pricing, after you've already accurately delineated the transaction. Right. So they're coming in using that provision to go back to change what the transaction is, which I would argue is not at all what the OECD transfer pricing guidelines are.
And they would argue that that's not what they're doing. I agree. I mean, I agree in concept. Why is that paragraph in the guidelines? And of course, it's repeated later on in the DEMPI guidance as well. So we've got it in the risk control guidance. Then we have it again in the DEMPI guidance with respect to IP transactions. So having gone through the process, the question then is, how do you value the contribution to control? But for the guidelines to then say there can be upside and downside attached to them, it's like, well, what is that transaction then? It doesn't necessarily mean we're disregarding the transaction that's the primary transaction that we're testing, but then to also be able to have another transaction that has upside and downside attached to it. How do we do that from a transfer pricing point of view? It's just a really difficult thing to execute, you know, to have a model that includes variability like that in essentially what most taxpayers would deem to be a cost plus type of activity, or an activity that's embedded within something else that they've benchmarked, essentially. So to pull that out and say, we now have this contribution to control that we're going to price with an upside and downside element, it's like, from an executional point of view, that's very difficult to do.
Now that we have this new guidance from HMRC, what are you advising taxpayers?
My advice to taxpayers is, first of all, to familiarize yourself with this guidance. It is not the easiest guidance, but to understand where HMRC are coming from is important. But the second thing I would say is to remember it's only guidance. Okay? There are different views on the guidelines, and this is HMRC's interpretation, but this hasn't necessarily been tested, certainly hasn't been legislated. So it doesn't mean you have to follow what HMRC are asking you to do here, but clearly this is providing you an understanding of how HMRC will test it. So it means that as you're thinking about your transfer pricing analysis, It's important to do so with a mindset that these are the things that HMRC are going to ask about. And if you take an alternative view, for example, you might say, well, we do have some people in the UK who are making important decisions, but they're within a tested entity, or they're in a cost plus sort of situation. Why is that okay? Yeah, and we can list the reasons here why that might be okay. We've got to bring options realistically available into the equation in any piece of transfer pricing analysis that we do. So if we've got one person making senior decisions from an economic perspective, what is it that gives that person bargaining power? You know, their personal contributions reflected in their compensation. And really, we need to find something else to ascribe value, and decisions on their own, I don't think that does that from an economic. How do you attach an economic value to a decision? I don't think it's possible to do that. So I think there are strong arguments to be made, but I just wouldn't be blasé about it, because what generally happens here is that HMRC do often find senior people taking significant decisions. And what then ends up happening is that they'll raise an assessment. And it's something that most taxpayers, on balance, given the time and expense involved, probably wouldn't want to litigate. They might ultimately go into a MAP process. But understanding where HMRC are going to be coming from is important, and understanding their expectations. Increasingly, their expectations are, and we're expecting to see more guidance later this year on this, possibly even more in the legislative space, is that you will have examined who the senior people are in the UK, that you'll have documented that, that you'll understand the kind of decisions that they're taking, and that you'll have documented that. And if there's a case to be made for your default transfer pricing policy, and more often than not there will be, that you've made the case, and you're not just waiting till HMRC kind of turn up to then start working out what it is you're going to say. So the main message, I think, is engage with the guidance and plan ahead. I'm clearly not advocating that you change your transfer pricing to be in keeping with HMRC's expectations here, because I don't agree with every element of this guidance. And so, but you do need to have thought about how you're going to engage, and you do need to demonstrate that you've dealt with these things thoughtfully. Because as I say, there's nothing in here that isn't in the transfer pricing guidelines. It's just HMRC's interpretation that is distinctive.
Thanks, Ian. I'd like to go back. You had mentioned accurate delineation. Can you provide our listeners with an explanation of why this is important?
Of course. You'll have noticed that the guidelines, and particularly if you saw the COVID guidance that came out from the OECD, rather than talking about transactions, they increasingly talk about the accurately delineated transactions. Accurate delineation is an integral part of the six-step risk process. And without going into too much detail, the way I think the process is supposed to work, and certainly most commentators that I've read think it should work, is that we start our transfer pricing analysis with the actual contracts that are in place. Okay. But what we're then doing in the six-step process is saying, is your decision making in keeping with your contractual arrangements? In particular, do you have enough control in the contractual location of the risk for the contract to be respected? If you have enough control, then in theory, you say, great, we respect your contracts, move on to pricing. But if you don't have sufficient control, it's clearly a question of what sufficient means, that's the big question, but if you don't have enough control, then in theory, what the guidelines are asking you to do is to then accurately delineate a transaction. And what I think that means is that you have to specify how the terms would differ from the terms that you have in your existing contract. How would those terms differ based on your behavior? But very importantly, the accurate delineation process does require you to specify what the new terms would be. Then you go ahead and do your transfer pricing based on those new terms. HMRC take a slightly different view. In fact, they take a very different view on this topic. So HMRC's view is that the process of accurate delineation is not a process of specifying an alternative contractual landscape. It's a process of taking all of the facts in the round, all of the economically relevant circumstances together, including your existing contractual terms, and the accurate delineation is really just another way of describing the full picture. And then it's based on the full picture, which they consider to be the accurate delineation, that you then go on and do your transfer pricing. But I would say, and as I say, many other commentators would say, you can't do transfer pricing like that. You need to have a contractual underpinning to be able to say with specificity who has the risk now and who owns the assets now, because that's from there does the transfer pricing proceed. And Christina, you mentioned earlier this point about this kind of defaulting towards a kind of headcount-based formulary apportionment type approach. Once you move away from contractual anchoring, either of risk or of assets, you're in a soup, you know, you're in a soup of facts, and you do end up kind of, you know, saying, well, what are we going to use as an alternative anchoring principle if we don't have that that contractual anchoring? And then we end up kind of then saying, well, we're having to think about something else like headcount. You know, there aren't many other kind of ways of doing it. And so that's why HMRC's view on what accurate delineation means is so important. And I stress this because I think that on this particular point, we are going to see in the future a lot more litigation unless we have clarity from the OECD, not only on what does this really mean, does it really mean that we have to come up with alternative contractual terms, but can the transfer pricing guidelines actually kind of create the license for a tax authority to do that? Now, in most jurisdictions, you would need some very significant domestic law rewrite to enable you to do that. And of course, the guidelines are not domestic law, they are guidance. So we've essentially got a rule within the guidelines, and having rules within the guidelines is problematic. But of course, because HMRC have legislated the guidelines, you know, we're living with this in our law. And yet alongside that, we've got domestic rules about how you go about doing contractual interpretation, you know, and that has a very specific, you know, it's got a very long history and it's got some very specific rules. And it's no wonder that HMRC don't want that to be what they have to do as part of this process, because as soon as we get into that, we're into a world where we're saying, well, OK, you're saying the contract should be different, but what do you think it should be? And how are you working that out based on behaviour? How do you work out a contract based on behaviour? It's really hard, you know, so it's not surprising that having the guidelines having gone in this direction, that HMRC might not really wish to engage with this idea of having to specify the alternative contractual terms. But my personal view is that you do need to do that. But what this guidance is saying is it's stopping short of that, stopping well short of that. And that's what's opening the door to the ambiguity.
That makes sense. I find this interesting that we can have sort of agreement around the world with respect to what the rules are, what the rules say, but so much disagreement and so much divergence in terms of how you actually apply and how you interpret those rules. Because as you mentioned, I don't think most jurisdictions are going to interpret these rules the same way that HMRC has.
It's really interesting because I fully agree with you on that point. The reality is that the guidelines themselves are very ambiguous on these topics. So there's a huge amount of room for manoeuvre, and it's a consensus document. It's inevitable sometimes that you've got a kind of a relatively high level set of rules which leave a lot of gaps. And that's the reality. And HMRC are trying to fill some of those gaps. And whilst you say that it seems unlikely that other tax authority, or maybe many other tax authorities, will follow this, and I'm paraphrasing, that's not actually what you said, we know very well that there are some jurisdictions that take a very that traditionally have taken a very contracts and assets based view of the world. But we also know that there are many jurisdictions, particularly in EMEA, but not only in EMEA, who are in tax audits seeking out senior decision makers as part of their audit. HMRC do it a lot, but they're far from the only tax authority that do that. And these tax authorities, having found such senior people making significant decisions, expect an attribution of profit one way or another to those people, whether it's through a higher margin in your tested party, whether it's through a profit split, a kicker, you name it, they'll be looking for more profit. It's just that some of those jurisdictions kind of are just taking it as read that that's what value creation means, and that's what the guidelines are kind of permitting us to do. HMRC have been challenged on this and have disciplined themselves to try and build a kind of intellectual framework that permits that kind of audit approach. But there are many other tax authorities who are taking that approach who perhaps haven't gone through the, you know, the rigor that HMRC have done. So, as I say, I have to applaud HMRC for doing that. It's just that the ideas themselves are challenging.
Understood. Thank you for all of this, Ian. This has been fantastic and very insightful. I appreciate all of your thoughts. Before we sign off, is there any final takeaways or closing comments that you would like to leave our listeners with?
I think we've covered most of what I wanted to say, and certainly I think we've covered everything that people are going to need to be aware about at a high level. Maybe a couple of things. I didn't mention earlier that this approach looks at individual risks or individual significant risks. So in most businesses will kind of be basketing risks together and saying that, you know, essentially we've got one contract in which all the risk is passed to the counterparty, and none of the risk or a minimal risk sits with the tested party. What we need to do is look at risks individually. So all the process we've talked about in terms of understanding where decisions are taken, we need to do that for individual risks. So I didn't mention that earlier, and I just wanted to flag it because, again, our listeners will be thinking, wow, I don't know how I would do that, but it's just a register that that's what you're supposed to be doing in HMRC's view. So that was one point to raise, and I appreciate that that was not really a rounding off type of point. It was kind of quite a detailed point. But in rounding off, the other thing I would say is that the OECD's next project after the pillars is the Global Mobility Project. And there are lots of different issues that are not transfer pricing issues in there, but there are transfer pricing issues in there. And one of them is, how do we deal with a situation where we have senior individuals who are making important decisions in our business, who are now dislocated from the location of our residual profit? Now, that's always happened, but it's happening with increasing regularity. And one of the questions that the OECD are posing themselves is, can we help taxpayers with some advice around in this area that can make their life easier? I mean, I'm assuming that's the OECD's challenge. I expect it is. It's very hard for them to approach that without engaging with some of the topics that we've been talking about today. So I would expect that the debate in this area will continue at the OECD level to some extent as the OECD move into their Global Mobility Project. But it might be some time yet before we start to see what really the international consensus view is on some of these topics. So in the meantime, it really is a case of understanding HMRC's perspective and being prepared to deal with that, I would say.
Ian, thank you again for joining me today and sharing your insights on this important and complex HMRC guidance. For more details, we've also published a tax insight that addresses this guidance, and a link to that insight is available on the episode page for this podcast at www.pwc.com/TP Talks. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next month with our next episode. And until then, have a great day.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.